Welcome to my talk on performance benchmarking with Celero. Now, other people pronounce this differently. I'm just going to go with Celero, and if I'm wrong, there'll be comments online, I'm sure, telling me that's not how we're supposed to pronounce that word. I've got six sections to the talk today. Some of it's going to be generic, just benchmarking information. And then there'll be some things specific to the Celero library. Real quick introduction. Who am I? I've got about 20 years of C++ experience. Not all that experience is created equal. I'm reformed and I'm doing much better now. My career mostly focused on modeling and simulation. I wanted to build a library and I was interested in performance, so I wrote a little benchmarking library that works on multiple platforms and can start to address some of the issues that my team was having with performance. Who am I not? That's also important to know who we're not talking to. Right, I am not the Stig. But I do care about performance, so we will go on with that performance theme throughout the talk. Lots of folks have laptops. The project is on GitHub. It just requires C++ 11 and CMake, and I've got that URL at the bottom of all the slides in teeny tiny print. So if you don't type it in fast enough or want to write it down later, it will be there for you. Autocorrect has been challenging while building this talk, so Celero is not produce. If you see celery on a slide, I apologize and I've missed it. It's also not an old processor. That also wants to get autocorrected. So if you see that, let me know. I'll try to fix it the next time around, but I've done my best. Celero is actually a micro benchmarking library. As I said, cross-platform. I wanted to make it easy to learn, so it looks a lot like Google Test. So if you've used Google Test or Boost Test or those things, it's a very similar syntax. It supports fixtures, as lots of testing libraries do. And it is a library. It is not header only, unfortunately. So a few quick words about micro benchmarking itself. There's lots of different kinds of benchmarking, and I just wanted to clarify what this is. And this is trying to measure the performance, maybe relative or absolute, of a small piece of your code. Maybe a critical algorithm, maybe a critical path, or maybe you want to do some design trade-offs and do some measurements. Micro benchmarks are a way of doing that. No talk on performance optimization would be complete without quoting this law. I've put some of the text up from Wikipedia, but the short of it is, and something to always keep in mind, and it is intuitive after someone says it for sure, is that the amount of performance improvement you're going to get out of optimization is going to be dependent on how much that thing you're optimizing participates in the overall system. So you could completely optimize away a function call, but if it's only called once on startup, you won't see any improvement because it just didn't participate in the overall system that much. So that's something to keep in mind whether you're doing micro benchmarking or performance-based measurements, dynamic profiling, those types of things. Always have guided optimization. That is, measure the performance. Prior to doing any optimization, make sure you have realistic conditions and you're operating at a realistic scale, because a lot of problems you only find at scale. So that's something to keep in mind. There's always a bottleneck, there's always the slowest part of your code, but there's other ways to optimize. Right now, with this library, we're talking about speed. But you may want to consider optimizing memory usage or disk access or the amount of power that you're consuming, other things. So this is really focused on speed, but there are other things you could be optimizing for as well. And the last point here is that you could maybe gain some performance with very esoteric coding, but that may be very hard to maintain. And if it ever breaks or ever needs modified, you need to always keep in mind maintenance. And don't do so much optimization that nobody can ever understand what you did. or your system just won't scale as you need to make changes and modify things. Microbenchmarking is just one tool that we have. This does not replace the other tools you may already be using, whether it's things like Intel VTune or AQTime or other dynamic analysis tools. Use them all. They all will probably give you different information in different ways and give you different insights. So just keep that in mind, that there's not a single hammer to solve the performance optimization problem. There are other benchmarking libraries. Google has one, Facebook has one, and there's a couple other projects out there on GitHub that I'm aware of. There is a nice little article comparing many of them. It's about a year old, but it's a nice article, just kind of going through some of the differences and whatnot, and I would encourage you to check that out, and then look at the updated versions of all the libraries, because I think, you know, everything evolves. Let's talk about challenges for benchmarking. The first problem, computers are really complicated. So when we're trying to make measurements, the operating system is always doing something else other than running our code and working on our measurement. Lots of cores are being tasked to do lots of other things. The processor may be changing speeds dynamically. And other things are going to be impacting our hardware too, such as cache and validation and things that we may not have control over while we're running the benchmark code. If we want to know the relative or absolute speed of some algorithm, there's going to be error incurred to measure that just inherently. We're going to have some timer calls, we're going to have some loops, we're going to have to shut down the timer, and all that stuff starts to add up. If you just look at some pseudocode, just basically if we were to run a benchmark, we're going to take a bunch of samples, we'll put that in a loop, and then for each of those samples we'll start the timer. We'll run over our code a couple times, maybe so it's using up some more clock, and then we can measure that. We'll shut the timer down and then record how long that took to do, and repeat the loop a few times, so then we have lots of samples and we can look at those samples and try to understand how long the do work thing actually took. But there's function calls, there's timer stuff in here, and it's all very fast, but it all adds up as well. And the computer has lots of opportunities to interrupt the things you're doing while this little loop is going on. Second challenge is that we all are complicated as well, and sometimes we get in our own ways. We constantly take shortcuts with the way we're thinking about things. We have lots of abstractions we apply to the world. We tend to use intuition. We tend to rely on it maybe a little too much. And even though a lot of us already know those things, that doesn't stop us from still making those same mistakes. And so while we're measuring and while we're doing optimization, we need to try to overcome our own biases, and let's not fall into traps that there is certain lore that you will find online and sage advice that maybe isn't actually true in your situation. So let's not make assumptions about whether it might be faster to inline or not, or maybe we should hand unroll the loops, or maybe we shouldn't. Let measurements and benchmarking and dynamic analysis answer these questions for you, and trust the results that you're getting from those things. Which is good measurements. That helps us overcome some of the problems with the computer interrupting us all the time. It also helps overcome our own preconceived notions about where fast code might be and slow code might be and how we can maybe improve it. And given all that, there's one more challenge. And that's the compilers are also complicated. They tend to be smarter than us. They only make programs equivalent to what we ask them to make. and that they try very hard to not waste time. Well, sometimes when you're writing benchmarks, we need them to waste time. We're going to be throwing away results, but we still want to incur the cost of saving the results. We may make calls that could be easily optimized away, but we don't want to do that because that's the exact thing that we're trying to measure. And so the library has a utility in it called Do Not Optimize Away. I know my library has this, Folly has this, and Google Benchmark also has it. You'll see it in various forms in a lot of the benchmarking libraries. The idea is to create a utility that will prevent unused variables and function calls from being optimized out. And yeah, you're going to force your program to do obviously useless work, but that useless work happens to be the thing that you want to measure. So this is the current implementation inside the library for Do Not Optimize Away. There's maybe two different versions of this in the library, and I'm just going to go over one of them. The basic trick here is that we're going to make a comparison that will always be false. But the compiler won't know that it's always going to be false. And so within the guts of the if statement, we're going to use the thing that we've passed in, so you can't optimize it out. We should never get inside the body of that if statement, but the compiler should also never be able to figure that out. So that's really the trick for Do Not Optimize Away, and in one form or another, this is the type of thing that all the libraries are doing for optimization here. So given these three kinds of challenges, what do we end up actually measuring within the benchmarking suite? I made up a formula, and it's not very complicated. And I think you all could make up your own, maybe with more terms, maybe with less. But for now, this is what I'm going to go with. We've got T measured. That's the total amount of stuff that we measured. So between starting the timer and stopping the timer, there's a bunch of things that went on. And so that's what we've actually measured. T actual is the time it took to do the actual work we're trying to measure. If all else, if you could make any changes here, you would just have T measured equals T actual, and that's the perfect number. We just can't get there because it's other things that are always going to be in the way. One of those is overhead. That's the loop construction, function calls, kind of the scaffolding that's in the benchmarking architecture itself. There's going to be some overhead there. There's going to be work that the system's doing, interrupting your process, you know, maybe moving you around, invalidating your cache, doing all these other things that maybe you are not interested in measuring the time of, but happen anyway. And the last one is just measurement error in general. We don't have that perfect access to the clock all the time. Between starting and stopping things, there's just overhead there. So there's going to be some error in just the measurement itself. And so as we go forward, I'll talk about how we can start to cancel out some of those terms. So we'll go through a quick example here. And for this, we're just going to try to look at the fastest way to convert an int to a string. Let's pretend we've done some measurements. The program does a lot of int to string kinds of conversions. We've got lots of ways to do this conversion, but we don't know which one we should go with. So what are we going to do? We will create a baseline, which is, in this case, what I've chosen is what's the best we might ever hope for int to string conversion. What's the ideal for that? And then we'll create a bunch of test cases to compare. There's lots of different ways you can choose a baseline, but for this example, we're just going to try to make the fastest conversion theoretically possible. So I've come up with a very advanced program where I just get a random number, which I'm going to convert, and then I'm just going to say that it's 42. So I'm not actually doing any conversion, but I'm going to say that we need to look at random ints and we want to convert them. I don't think intuitively, problem number two, that we could ever get faster than just creating an int and then creating the string. That seems really fast. But when we compile that, it does surprisingly little. It doesn't actually build a string. It does actually call rand, which I thought was a little surprising. That broke my intuition. But there's not a lot there. So we have to add in our do not optimize away. So we add some extra scaffolding in, and now we've got a bunch of assembly. And I don't read assembly. But there's a lot of stuff there, and we can see the call to standard chrono, which is the do not optimize away stuff that's in there. And this goes on and is much larger, and we can see some strings and things. And I have a link there at the bottom so you can pull it up and look at all that glorious assembly if that's your thing. But the point is that we've verified now that our baseline is doing the kind of thing that we actually want it to do. And that helps us attack challenge number 3. We have to inspect the assembly. We added scaffolding to that baseline case through 2 calls to do not optimize away. We need to make sure that we have 2 calls to do not optimize away in all of the benchmark cases that we're going to write, just to keep that even. So here's how it actually looks within the library. We call it a baseline macro. We give it a name of a test suite. Group name, demo 2 string. This test name is going to be called baseline, very creatively. We're going to take 10,000 samples, and for each of those samples, we're going to iterate over this little function 1,000 times. So we're going to call this function, this 3-line function, 1,000 times, and record how long that took. And we're going to do that 10,000 times. And look at all those samples and all those measurements. And the reason we do this is to try to cancel out some of these errors. That first 1,000, the number of iterations, helps cancel out some of the timing error. If you're too fast, you just won't be able to start and stop your timer fast enough to really get an accurate measurement. So we're going to run it 1,000 times just to try to spread that cost out over 1,000 calls to the function. Then, to help cancel out some of that system error, we're going to do 10,000 samples. So if in one of those samples you decided to write some data to disk somewhere, or things had to get invalidated, we're going to take 10,000 samples and hope that one of those is really good. The overhead will be in those do not optimize away calls. We'll have to just make sure that we're repeating that in each of the cases. So hopefully that helps tie together some of the factors in our total measurement and how that's expressed within the library itself. We want to drive as many of those factors as we can to 0, and we do that through just canceling them out. So if we do lots of measurements and we have the same scaffolding in place, hopefully when we're all done, those terms start to cancel each other out. Test cases look something like this. They're going to be in this group called demo 2 string, because that's what we created. That way when we run the cases, they'll all be grouped together and compared with each other. We're going to look at a 2 string implementation. We'll look at stir stream. We'll measure that as well. And that's kind of all 3 of those things put together. So that's just what all the code would look like you would need to take that very optimistic baseline case and then measure 2 string versus stir string. And I will do just a complete walkthrough of this entire test suite. If you downloaded it through GitHub, you would see all the code. I am not an optometrist, and I don't expect you to read on the right what's going on, but I'm just going to step through. That's the whole file. But I'm just going to show a few of the pieces. There's a very common header. We have a macro called Celero Main. That's a lot like what's in Google Test. I'm going to do some hand waving here. There's just some lookup tables and some other implementations that are coded in that we're going to call in some of the other test cases. That's what makes up the majority of the file here. We've got our baseline, the benchmarks we saw. At the bottom there's an extra benchmark for just a table lookup. And then 2 more algorithms that we want to look at. So we're going to compare all of these different ways of doing an int to string conversion together. The command line is very complicated. You just run the program. Celero demo toString. When you run that, you'll get some colored output in a table in your terminal. Kind of going from left to right, it's the group name that we saw, demo toString, the experiment. So you'll see the baseline, the toString cases, and those things. I'm going to talk about problem spaces and samples and iterations and why those are important in a second, but let me just kind of zoom in on the important parts of this table. And so there's going to be a baseline measurement. That's always going to have a 1.0 value in the baseline column. I'll also show the number of microseconds per iteration. That's how long it took to call the body of the function and how many of those you could do per second. Yeah, the math is easy to do, but I found it handy to just have that number right there for me. And now we're going to look at toString. Took about twice as long as the baseline. The stir stream example took about 19 times longer than the baseline. Simple table lookup seems to be on par, 0.96. The Hopman fast algorithm is about one as well. So that's kind of what came out of this. The baseline case is really critical. And I will probably repeat myself in this talk, but those microseconds per iteration, that's measuring the cost of do not optimize away. So I don't know if I would really look at the total number of microseconds here because it includes a lot of scaffolding. But that baseline case shows you the relative performance of the algorithms. And for this, when we just want to know how we should update our software, that's really the most important number on here. The other thing to note is you will get consistent results if you set your experiment up correctly. So here I've ran it 3 times in a row, and you'll see that in all but the stir stream cases, we're getting exactly the same measurements. And I can theorize on why stir stream was not consistent, but the important thing here really is that we are getting consistent measurements when you set your test suite up correctly. And that means that hopefully I ran this on my little MacBook here. If you take it and run it on a big development desktop, you should see some of those same relative costs. The microseconds might all change, but those relative costs may translate very well. Of course, processor architecture differences, and depending on the complexity of your case, you may see some variance. But this allows developers on the same team with different hardware to communicate about relative performance of benchmarks, which is important. So let's talk about some of the art for constructing the baselines and test cases themselves. I didn't feel like typing up a test fixture definition, so I copied one from JUnit. But we have test fixtures, and we can use that to help provide consistency in the setup of all of our test cases. And the API itself is modeled strongly after Google Test. So now we'll do something like measure sorting algorithm performance, because that's only slightly more interesting than int-to-string conversion. And yeah, you could look this stuff up, but measuring it's also kind of fun. So we're going to create a sort fixture. We're going to talk about the experiment values in a minute, but one thing I want to show here is that we have a setup function that's going to happen outside of your measurement. We're going to have onExperimentStart, which is going to be called and measured, so you can do uniform initialization for all of your test cases that needs measured there. After that, your actual test case itself will be ran. The baselines, the benchmarks, those little functions will get ran. Then when they're done, we'll call onExperimentEnd, and that time will be measured as well. That makes up the guts of the sample, and when that sample is done, teardown will be called. So that provides you a way to get uniform setup, teardown, and initialization for all of your test cases to help make sure that you've got the same scaffolding in place for situations that are more complex. Celero supports 2 different kinds of baseline measurements. One is the measured baseline, which is what I just showed. You can also set up an absolute baseline, and I will talk about those. For the baselines, if you're going to measure, pick a standard example. That's some of my advice there. If you're going to work on a sorting algorithm, maybe your baseline case would be sorting a vector of random ints, because that's kind of, you're not an optimized case. You're probably going to be slower than that in whatever you're doing. You could pick a naive example. You could take your current implementation that you want to measure against and make that your baseline case, so you can see if things are getting better or worse as your code changes. Or you could just use something out of the standard library as your baseline case if there's a similar type of algorithm there. So for our sorting random ints, I've chosen the venerable bubble sort as our baseline case, and just put an implementation of bubble sort in the body of the function. You'll see that it has a extra call there. It's got the F on the end to say I want to use fixtures, and then the name of the fixture class is added into the macro itself.
Question?
Sir?
So, aren't you going to get really bad baselines if you put random numbers in every time, or are you going to have a fixed set of random?
Well, we could argue, the question was about should we use the same set of random numbers or a different set of random numbers every time. I wouldn't disagree that it would be better to have the same set of random numbers every time. I just didn't want to put that much effort into building this demo. So yes, scientifically, that would make for a better measurement. But for here, it should be suitable for our needs for the briefing. We can also do absolute baselines. And that may be something like, I just need to get this thing running 100 times a second or 1,000 times a second. I've got a target I'm aiming for. You can just put that number in directly. Nothing will get ran. It'll just record your baseline case and the number of microseconds that takes and move on and start to compare everything against a fixed number. We've also got problem spaces, and I've kind of glossed over it two or three times so far in the talk, but I will get into it now. And that's a way to address the fact that many problems require just an extra dimension of the testing, because some solutions really scale better than others. And maybe the fastest at a very small case is not going to be your optimal when you have realistically sized data. And so problem spaces allow us to build a test vector to run the baseline and the test cases against kind of uniformly and see how problems scale. Excuse me. Inside the test fixture, there is a call to get experiment values. And that returns a, inside there you build up a pair of, in this case, it'll be the number of elements that we want to sort, and the second value helps control the way the test runs, and I will demonstrate that. So here we're going to start sorting an array of size 64 and then scale that up to an array of size of 4096. And now when we create our benchmarks, they're all using the test fixture, and they will all be sorting arrays that will get larger as the test progresses. And those times will get measured and excuse me, and sorted accordingly. That second parameter allows us to vary the number of iterations that we're going to perform each time. Excuse me. The total number of iterations you may want to scale, because things are going to get longer and longer as size increases. So here's an example where a problem space is increasing 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, etc. And then I'm going to lower the number of iterations every time. That way I'm not using up as much time to collect the measurements. That the body of that function is going to take a lot longer to run as the problem space increases, so I'm not going to run it as many times per sample. That way we can kind of control some run times and those types of things accordingly. And I will do another complete code walkthrough of this. Again, same headers we saw before. Then we have our test fixture. The get experiment values is filled out, so we can scale up the size of our vector as we are progressing. We've got a setup function that's going to set the size of our array, resize the array itself, and then we will effectively start the timer on experiment start will get called. That's going to generate different random numbers for every sample there, every iteration, I'm sorry. And at the end, we'll clear out the array, and we don't really have any teardown actions here. So by the time we get into our baseline, our bubble sort, it will be ready to go with a sized vector with random ints in it. I went ahead and set up some constants for the number of samples and the number of iterations here, as I wasn't varying that for this example. And we will do a selection sort and an insertion sort. And then a quick sort and standard sort. So that's a good sampling of standard sorting algorithms. And when we run all that, you may be able to see that the bubble sort gets ran several times, each with an array of different size. And then we mark all of those baselines as 1.0 and measure the microseconds per iteration for each of those. And just with the sample of the output here, you'll notice everything is green below that because bubble sort is the worst way to sort these values, and everything beats it. So some guidelines, whether you're using this library or another library, is make sure that you're only measuring release-optimized types of builds. Make sure that the scaffolding that you've added to your baseline is repeated in your test cases, and vice versa. Make sure you're using realistic problem sizes so you can see if things are scaling appropriately, and make sure you use more than one tool, regardless of what you're picking. So with any of these tools, for me, something that tends to get left out is the part where you actually want to look at the data. A lot of people end up writing post-processors and parsers and little MATLAB utilities and all sorts of things to suck data in from applications that generate good data but don't give you any way to look at it. And so in my library, I wanted to try to address some of that. You have to still understand the data, though. So I mentioned this before, but remember that the scaffolding is included. And if you have lots of extra calls to do not optimize away, I don't suggest you really put a lot of credence on the absolute times that are measured here. Instead, look at the baseline and the relative performance. On the other hand, if you don't have a lot of scaffolding and it really is just your core algorithm, you can look at those absolute times and start to make some judgments on that. When you run, beware of suspiciously consistent results. This is a demo application that you'll get that tries to measure how long it takes to pass a variable into a function. And now that should be very fast and very hard to measure. And here I decided to pass 100 variables and measure that time, and I measured it 1,000 times. And what you'll see is that those numbers are all suspiciously consistent. And they're very round, and I would expect that I would see some more variance in the numbers. And I think what's happened here, again going back to intuition, for better or worse, is that this has happened so fast, and I've done so few of them, I'm just really measuring how long it takes to start and stop the timer. So, we're going to bump up the number of iterations. Here I can barely read it even on my screen, 100,000. And now the numbers have some more variance in them. And I start to feel better about this. So I'm not even sure that this is right at this point, but beware if your results are overly consistent. I would question that. If you just look at the Celero command line, there's a standard list test. You can look at all the groups that are in there. But there's a couple outputs that you'll be able to get. And one is just going to be a table output, another is JUnit. And there is also an archive file that I will talk about. The CSV output is really easy to read in. It's got a couple columns in it. The first set of columns are kind of your setup, what you were seeing at the command line, your group name, experiment name, the problem space, the number of samples, the number of iterations. The next couple columns are going to be the actual measurements, and then at the end are going to be some statistics. Now, I'm giving you statistics, but realize that we should not be looking at the mean. We should not be looking at the max. The number that we care about is the min. Do not average your results here. Only take the minimum result. Why do I say that? Because if you remember our fake equation that I came up with, we want all those terms to be as small as possible except for the actual measurement. So anything that's larger than that is a source of error. So we want the measurement with the least amount of error, which will be the smallest measurement. I do provide the statistics here because it might be good to know what kind of spread you're getting if you need to do more iterations or more samples to make sure that you're getting good statistically sound results. But really, you just want to look at the minimum for absolute costs. Then you can pull that in. Here I pulled it into Excel, set my axes to be log 2, and plotted the results of our sorting test. Very easy, didn't have to write anything extra. You just open it up in Excel, build a chart. There's also another GitHub project out there called PyCelerograph. It uses Python to read those files and gives you a nice web page with Bokeh graphs on it that you can zoom in and zoom out and pan around and all those types of things. It's a very cool, and I appreciate those folks for writing that. There's also an archive file, and this is something that I've been playing with to try to help integrate this type of testing into continuous test. So Celery is going to update the archive file every time it runs, keep some historic information, and also keep the most current information as far as measurements go, and store some more statistical measurements along with that as well. Again, it's CSV, so it's going to be very easy to parse. It's got a lot of the same information that the table output did, along with a lot more statistics information, and then information about your historic maxes and mins and those types of things. But if you don't want to write a front end to look at that thing and monitor that, it will also output just JUnit results. So if you have continuous delivery stuff already in place, chances are it can read JUnit outputs, and so you can just look at the Accelero results directly in those tools. Which brings us to integrating all of this stuff into continuous test, which is what kind of started this for me. It was getting very difficult to know in the code base when things were getting faster and slower, and when somebody checked something in that looked like perfectly legit code, but completely killed performance in critical ways. It took too long to find out that that happened and to trace back to what the actual cause was. So how do we get this into continuous test? Chances are, a lot of you are already doing this. And there's a lot of third-party tools out there to help. I've got experience with Bamboo and Jenkins, but there's others out there as well. I think we could also write new plugins for these to help visualize these results specifically, because they're a slightly different flavor than a lot of just regular unit test results are. Something that I think could be improved is that Celero should be able to track failure conditions for JUnit. That is, set up a baseline that you don't want to go below this measurement, or you don't want to exceed your best performance by more than 5%, things like that, so that it can actually set up a JUnit failure and get those failures reported in your test system. And there would just be some enhancements, I think, to the archive file and some of the setup, but I think that would be something that would be very helpful to add in. However, benchmarking is different than unit testing, and it really wants to have more control over the machine I know our servers get bombarded various times throughout the day with other people's work. And it's not such a big deal when you're just building and running unit tests, but if you're executing performance measurements, it is critical. And so what are some of your options for dealing with that in your continuous test environment? Spoiler alert, I don't have the perfect answer. One of them might just be scheduling. We schedule our builds to happen at different times of the day. Maybe at 4 a.m, the servers are generally not doing anything. Let's run our performance measurements then. It may also be possible to check for CPU activity before running the benchmarks to make sure that the system's relatively idle before you get started. You could also just be greedy and set your affinities and process priorities and stop everybody else's builds, but don't worry about it. That can be very dangerous. You've got a really high priority and you screwed something up in your test, everyone will let you know about it because the system will still be hung when everybody gets to work in the morning. And then it's very hard to kill and all those types of things. So I think there's probably a happy medium here. You can probably bump up the priority, and that's something that we could add into the library, but I'm not sure it completely solves the problem. Unfortunately, where we're at on our team is we just have not integrated this into continuous test. We'll just run it ourselves because we have a lot more control over our individual machines. And I'm going to lunch. I'll run the test while I'm at lunch. Close my internet connection, shut everything down, have a relatively clean machine, and upload those results. It's not as automated as I like things to be, but right now that's kind of where we have to be on our team. So, just to recap, there's a lot of challenges when we're doing micro benchmarking, independent of the architecture that you're using for that. Always measure performance before beginning optimization, and inspect the assembly as you're writing these baselines and test cases to make sure things aren't getting completely optimized out. Celero itself is very similar to Google Test and its API. You can either use measured or absolute baselines, which is interesting. Try to drive for consistent results. You build up a test suite, run it 2 or 3 times, make sure you're getting the same numbers, and if you're not, you're going to have to play with the number of iterations and the number of samples to try to get that to be more consistent. So what needs done in the future? I think Do Not Optimize Away itself is a little heavyweight, and we need a lighter weight way of doing that. I've lacked the creativity or desire to spend much time looking into a better way of doing it. Automatically tuning the number of iterations and samples, there's a little bit of that code in there now, but I think someone with a strong statistics background would be able to help with that a lot, to kind of be able to tune those things automatically so that you would be guaranteed more consistent results right off the bat without having to play with those numbers yourself. Then being able to add goals or some type of failure condition to the JUnit output to make it easier to integrate into continuous test, I think would be a big improvement. So that's it for my talk. Thank you all very much for showing up. Thank you. And we have a few minutes for questions if anybody has one. If not, then enjoy the rest of the conference.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. Can you talk to how the tests are actually run? Like, does that table come up all at once, or does it incrementally come as the results?
Yeah.
Or do you interleave the tests that you register?
Right. So that table that you saw, the colored output, it displays that as it's figuring it out. So when one baseline completes all of its iterations, all of its samples, it outputs that line of result. So you can kind of monitor it as it's going and seeing if things are getting horrible and you need to stop it or whatnot. So. Mm-hmm. All right, well, I'll be available afterwards. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.